I have a legal mechanism now where I don't have to pay $36,000 a year for health insurance.
It's not insurance, but a religious-based approach to health care may work for some Alaskans facing steep insurance rates. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, students from Bethel's Yupik Immersion School get back to class.
We had stuff flown in from EEC. We had things from all over the school district that was brought in to get these kids back in classroom.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Results of the new Alaska Measures of Progress standardization tests were made public today in Anchorage. Alaska Education Commissioner Mark Hanley says he is excited about the data gained from the first implementation of the AMP. Hanley says results of the spring 2015 tests are to become the baseline data for assessing the results of tougher state education standards.
This is the new year, a new baseline, a new test. It is significantly different. The expectations are significantly different.
General statewide results show that less than half the students tested meet proficiency standards in English language arts, and between 20 and 40% achieve proficiency in mathematics. The commissioner did say that in some school districts, 60% of students met the higher level results. Hanley stated that although the results show room for improvement, they also show that the education department has raised the bar to make the tests more difficult.
If you look at level two, it says students may have gaps in knowledge and skills, but are still capable of most grade level content. We felt that these terms of meeting standards and partially meeting standards really accurately reflected where students were. Previously, we used terms like proficient and not proficient. Well, if you're not proficient, it feels like you didn't get over this bar. You were not close. You didn't make it. This recognizes that students are operating at grade level, may have most of the standards under their belt, but may still have some gaps that they need to address.
The AMP tests are given to grades 3 through 10. Students score in four levels, from low to high. Students scoring in levels 3 and 4 are meeting the new standards, while students scoring in the first two levels only partially meet them. Hanley says the new AMP scores are not comparable to the old standards because the new tests are more difficult and use a different type of scoring. A breakdown of scores by grade and by school district is available on the Department of Education webpage. Parents can expect student-level reports later this month. As health insurance rates rise out of reach for many Alaskans, some residents are turning to an alternative: Christian Healthcare Sharing Ministries. These religiously affiliated organizations are legal under the Affordable Care Act. Members pay a monthly fee and are eligible to have medical expenses over a certain amount reimbursed. It's not insurance, but it's an appealing option for Alaskans priced out of the individual insurance market. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
When Lane Chesley first heard about healthcare sharing ministries, the idea sounded too good to be true. The Homer resident had just received notice from Moda Health that the insurance rate for him and his wife, Melody, was increasing to more than $2,000 a month.
It was sort of like we're put in a position where we really have no choice but to opt out of the traditional insurance because we just simply can't afford the premiums in the individual market where they're going to.
Chesley doesn't regularly attend church, but he started researching the Mennonite-affiliated Liberty HealthShare, based in Ohio. For a monthly contribution of $300, he and his wife can access shared funds from the health ministry for medical expenses over $1,000 per incident. The ministry handles bills and negotiates rates with providers. Chesley was impressed enough to pass on the information to other friends in Homer facing the same predicament.
We all started Googling, HealthShare Ministries to see if we could find any articles or, informations about how these healthshare ministries had failed their members, and we couldn't find any.
And Chesley's research didn't stop there.
Yeah, I'm Timothy Jost, and I'm an emeritus professor at Washington and Lee University.
Jost is an East Coast health reform expert who also happens to be a cousin of Chesley's wife.
And in our family, cousins, that's a close relationship.
Jost told Chesley, yeah, this might be your best alternative, but there is some risk. Healthcare sharing ministries are not insurance, so they're not bound by strict government regulations for insurance. For example, they aren't required to have cash reserves to help ensure they stay solvent. The ministries are also free from some Affordable Care Act rules. They can impose maximum benefit amounts and screen members for pre-existing conditions to help manage costs. And Joe says he's worried the ministries will struggle as they grow.
Historically, the healthcare sharing ministries have functioned very well, but historically they were not terribly big and also were limited to people who really felt strongly about their mission and their beliefs.
Liberty HealthShare has had a big jump in membership this year. Executive Director Dale Bellis says the nonprofit has added 1,000 members per month since the start of 2015 and now has about 30,000 members nationwide. Bellis says that growth is a challenge, but it's manageable.
It's been a fun challenge.
Some healthcare sharing ministries require members to attend church regularly and even ask for a letter from a pastor as proof. Bellis says Liberty HealthShare doesn't intrude on personal faith choices, in his words. He says the organization does ask members to agree to treat their bodies as temples, a core belief that also helps contain healthcare costs.
We ask that you accept our shared beliefs, and it's essentially wrapped around the values that say God has given us our rights, and we have the moral and spiritual responsibility to care for our bodies and help others when they're in need.
Lane Chesley and his wife became members of Liberty HealthShare starting November 1st. Chesley looked at it like a math problem. If he and his wife went uninsured in 2016, they would pay a penalty of about $4,000. It didn't cost much more for the couple to join Liberty HealthShare.
The math just seemed to stack up to say it's worth a try, regardless of whether or not I ever get anything reimbursed or not, because I no longer have to pay. I have a legal mechanism now where I don't have to pay $36,000 a year for health insurance.
Even though he's not a part of it anymore, Chesley worries about the future of Alaska's individual health insurance market. With healthy people like him and his wife opting out, that will leave a smaller pool to cover healthcare costs for those who remain. And that could drive already unaffordable rates up even higher. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska tribes and health providers are using federal dollars to combat methamphetamine use and suicide. The Federal Indian Health Service awarded the Alaska Native Tribal Health Corporation $200,000 out of the $1.6 million that was set aside in September for suicide and meth use prevention efforts. The corporation hosted one of two recent conferences in Anchorage that sought to educate officials about warning signs of meth use, as well as spotting labs where the drug is being made. Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation program evaluator Mark Anaruk said most suicides occur while people are under the influence. Detectives and experts say methamphetamine is one of the top drugs of choice in Alaska. Bethel-based Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation and the South Central Foundation in Anchorage were each awarded $275,000. Students from Bethel's Yupik Immersion Institution returned to school today after 4 days without classes following the Kilbuck fire. Teachers, parents, and community members worked through the weekend setting up temporary classrooms in the school district office to prepare for the kids' arrival. Rows of headlights stretched outside the building this morning as school buses and parents lined up to drop off their K through third graders. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur caught up with Joshua Gill, director of personnel for the district, in the parking lot as he and other staff coordinated traffic.
So this seems kind of amazing that less than a week ago is when the fire happened and now it's Monday and you're back in school. Is this a fast turnaround for this type of event?
Absolutely, I think so, but I also think it's the spirit of LKSD. We chip in across the district. We had stuff flown in from EEC. We had things from all over the school district that was brought in to get these kids back in classroom.
And then have you been able to talk with any of the parents or kids and hear what they've been saying today?
Unfortunately, no. I've been out here directing traffic, but I did see a few smiling faces walking into their classrooms this morning, so it was really good.
Today, have you heard from teachers, I guess, kind of like what the plan is?
It's basically we'll get kids back in, learn their new routines because they're going to the bathroom a different place, just getting those patterns set up, where they're going to eat lunch, where they're going to play on the playground, all those things established, and just get back into the school routine. It's almost like the first day of school.
And what about the state of the UPIC materials? Where do those materials come from?
All over the state. I know there's stuff coming in from Fairbanks, UConn School District, throughout LKSD schools. We're getting pieces all over. We're gathering them and seeing what we have and finding the holes, those things we still need to do. But it's amazing. You got a staff in there, a very veteran staff, a very dedicated staff. They were in there and creating stuff all weekend long for their kids for at least this week.
And lastly, when you said that they were working here all weekend, what does that mean? What were they working on?
Setting up their classroom, getting ready for the kids to be in the first day. What a lot of people don't realize for primary teachers, those little things, the name tags on the desk, the routines on the wall, those pieces that they need to have a successful day, especially their first day.
Governor Bill Walker visited Bethel on Friday to meet with city and school officials as well as teachers and students displaced by last week's fire. Mayor Rick Robb presented the governor with the city's disaster proclamation, asking the governor to declare an emergency and allocate recovery resources. City Council will vote to approve the declaration at Tuesday's meeting. City Manager Ann Capella told the governor Bethel requires more cleanup assets than initially expected. The city discovered asbestos contamination in the collapsed school, and Capella is asking the governor for resources to properly dispose of the rubble and to test emergency personnel for toxins. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, measuring the impact of tundra fire on permafrost.
Sometime between the second and the seventh year following the fire, permafrost started to thaw, and in particular, iceberg permafrost started to thaw.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The city of Homer wants the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities to pay a little more than $26,000 in natural gas assessments for 8 state-owned plots of land. DOT refuses. KBBI's Quinton Chandler reports the city and DOT are negotiating a solution.
Natural gas seems to be the fossil fuel that can do no wrong. It has boomed in popularity, not just in Alaska, but the rest of the U.S. and countries across the globe. It's relatively cheap and clean. Those benefits were not lost on the Homer City Council when they started down the path to a gas transition. The city used a legislative grant to pay for a pipeline to bring the gas from Anchor Point into Homer and Kachemak City. But the city borrowed over $12 million from the Kenai Peninsula Borough to pay for the 73-mile distribution system used to deliver the gas to individual properties.
Part of that project, the city decided to create a very large all-city special assessment district that assesses each property equally for putting natural gas in all the streets and right-of-ways in Homer.
The assessments just mentioned by Homer City Manager Katie Kester were set aside by the city to pay its debt to the borough, and DOT has properties inside that special assessment district.
We're engaged in conversations right now with DOT about those properties and getting payment from them and letting them know that just because it's a state property doesn't mean it's excluded from the district.
Kester says only undevelopable properties are excluded from the district, and on that, DOT agrees. Jill Reese with the Department of Transportation says the properties in question are right of way.
Whenever we expand a road, sometimes we don't have enough of an easement or a owned property already that the road already traverses in order to make it wider or longer. Sometimes we have to go out and buy extra property from private individuals in order to do that.
Once those properties are purchased, they are labeled right-of-ways, and state statute forbids developing them.
It's not subject to the assessment since there's no opportunity to develop the property and take advantage of that gas line.
But Kester says the properties she's talking about are developable, and right now the city is trying to explain that to the agency.
A lot of these properties are benefited properties. They have facilities on them and structures on them. So right now, I think that it's really just a matter of engaging in conversation with DOD and educating them about, the types of properties.
Kester says the city has already exempted DOT properties that she calls truly undevelopable.
Only a road is on them, or there would be no ability to build a structure.
Kester adds that other state entities have paid assessments on their lots. She is confident the city and DOT will find a solution to their disagreement. She also says it's important for the public to know everyone with properties inside the district is being treated to the same standard. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
The city of Homer will return some of the payments received in the 90 days before Buccaneer Oil filed for bankruptcy in May 2014. The city is agreeing to repay $8,730 rather than the nearly $17,500 demanded by the law firm representing the oil company's liquidating trust. City Attorney Thomas Klinkner negotiated the reduced amount. In an October 26th report, City Manager Katie Koster said it gives her heartburn to agree to the repayment, but that the move saves money on potential legal fees. Buccaneer Oil's trustees have requested the return of preferential payments made to several businesses and groups. Homer Electric Association spokesman Joe Gallagher says the utility also negotiated a significant reduction in its repayment. It's unclear whether other payments have been settled. Researchers say more than half the ice locked up in glaciers could be gone by the end of the century. A new study published in the journal Frontiers of Earth Science says the resulting runoff could raise the Earth's oceans 3 inches or more. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the study suggests fisheries and hydroelectric dams could also be impacted by the change.
Regina Hawk is professor of geophysics at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She and her colleague in Switzerland gathered data from some 200,000 glaciers from around the world. They then ran those numbers through 14 different computer models looking at different temperature and greenhouse gas scenarios. She says their findings refine and confirm the results of earlier studies.
We found that all glaciers in the world may lose between 25% and 48% of their current volume, depending on the emission scenarios, depending on how much greenhouse gases are going to be in the atmosphere.
Hawk says that the melting glaciers will raise the world's seas between 3 to 6 inches, with Alaska's glaciers contributing about a half inch to that rise. She says there's some 25,000 glaciers in the state. Further, Hawk says the impact on glacier melt extends beyond rising oceans.
As the glaciers disappear, there's a decrease in stream flow, so that will affect water availability for hydropower or any other users. It also affects the chemistry of the and temperature of the stream flow, and that can have effects on fisheries.
Hawk says that she and her colleagues didn't model the ice sheets of Greenland or Antarctica because ice sheet dynamics are different and other scientists are modeling them. But those models suggest melting ice sheets will also play a profound role in rising ocean levels. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Wildfire on Arctic tundra can cause permafrost melt from the top down, contributing to landscape slumping, known as thermokarst. The U.S. Geological Survey study used airborne technology called LIDAR to collect billions of data points on the landscape surface. The remote sensing equipment uses lasers to build topographical maps. USGS geographer Ben Jones led the field work. The study looked at the area burned by the Anituvik River fire in 2007 that burned 400 square miles. Jones says they didn't study the entire area, but found measurable differences between the studies conducted in the years after the fire.
So we found that basically sometime between the second and the seventh year following the fire, permafrost started to thaw, in a particular ice-rich permafrost started to thaw, and that led to development of thermokarst features or landforms on the landscape.
What happens then because of that thawing? What changes other than the fact that it's thawed?
Yeah, so the roughness of the landscape changes in particular, and development of thermokarst features and landforms are known to impact terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems. They have an influence on hydrology. And then it could also potentially lead to thaw of carbon that was previously stored frozen in permafrost.
The difference that you saw in the 5 years, how great was the change?
I would say it was particularly surprising how widespread it actually was. When we actually got the data sets, we were able to create these highly detailed topographic models of the landscape and difference them. So within the burned portion of the area that we studied, so that 300 square kilometer area that was within the Anaktuvik River fire extent, we found that more than 30% of the area had subsided, or we could detect thermokarst development across more than 30% of that study area. One particular feature that was really prevalent in the aftermath of the fire were degrading ice wedges. So these massive ice deposits within the permafrost, and some of those features subsided more than 2 to 3 meters.
So there's like large lumps of ice, and those are moving? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, there's large deposits of ice in the ground, massive ice deposits. And one particular type of massive ice deposit is an ice wedge. And so they form over a periods of thousands of years. The ground will crack in the wintertime, and then snowmelt runoff in the spring will fill the cracks from the winter, and then basically over time you accumulate ice in the ground in roughly a little wedge shape. And so that was one of the most prevalent changes occurring after the fire were degradation of these ice wedge features.
Do you see that maybe the next study will look at the feedbacks or what's next for this research?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. So basically this pretty novel data set that we were able to put together and analyze can feed into ongoing research in the study area, so you can actually assess what the mechanisms were driving this delay or this lag in thermokarst development following the fire, but then also going forward what the future impacts are of not only this tundra fire, but potentially future tundra fires in the Arctic.
Ben Jones is a research geographer with the USGS. The study was published in the latest online edition of Scientific Reports.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Celebrate National Philanthropy Day in Alaska and honor outstanding small businesses like Two Friends Gallery for their work to make Alaska a better place to live and raise Alaskan families. Join the celebration on Friday, November 20th at the Denina Center. Visit afpalaska.net. This message sponsored by Alaska Public Media and AFP Alaska.
Southeast Alaska's largest environmental organization is advertising for a new executive director. Melina Marvin has led the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council for close to 2 years. She's stepping down after being diagnosed with breast cancer. Marvin says her prognosis is good, but she needs time to recover and prevent a recurrence. Under her leadership, SEAC expanded its opposition to British Columbia mine projects near waterways that flow into Alaska. It formed a new group, Inside Passage Waterkeeper, and worked with other environmental, fisheries, tourism, and tribal groups opposing transboundary mining.
We are of people who survive on fish and seafood, and we need clean water if that's going to continue being a healthy resource for communities.
It's also continued work on climate change, forest preservation, and transportation. Marvin continues to do some work for SEAC. Her resignation takes effect January 1st. The burned-out Gastineau apartments are supposed to be demolished in April, but a last-minute deal could restore the downtown dwelling in Juneau. 3 years after the fire, the owner has a purchase agreement with a Seattle developer. It's on the assembly agenda for today. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins talked with one man who lost almost everything but would consider calling Gastineau home again.
So I would go in through the front door right here, Will Muldoon lived at the Gastineau Apartments for about 5 years.
So that was my living room.
And he says the street was always bustling with activity. Bars letting out after last call, the occasional smell of acetone from the nail salon below. And he says, sure, sometimes it could be uncomfortable.
Part of living downtown is one time I stepped out of the shower and my neighbor saw me, so I had to go over and say sorry to them. But, you know, I think that was just, it's part of the fun of living downtown in close quarters.
That neighbor was working at the Doll Museum across the street. Still, he says he loved living at the Gastineau in a small one-bedroom. Muldoon paid around $950 a month for rent. He worked two jobs, and the location gave him the flexibility to walk to work in the day, come home and do IT at night.
It was kind of neat. My life was very localized, and I liked it that way.
Then 3 years ago this month, Muldoon's life changed. Clanging fire alarms woke him up, but he just rolled back over and went to sleep.
The way Beck was knocking, Officer Beck was knocking on the door, I could tell it wasn't just like, oh, hey, let's chat type of thing, you know.
Can you recreate it?
Yeah, it was like a... It was a big one. It wasn't, no, hello, you know, I'm trying to sell something or anything like that.
Muldoon escaped with a pair of extra tufts and his dog. Even the clothes on his back had to be thrown away from smoke damage. But all of the tenants, minus one cat, made it out. Gastineau's owner, James Barrett, repeatedly missed city deadlines for repairs or demolition, and the building caught on fire again. It's been a huge eyesore, even declared a safety concern. So the city put together a bid package for Gastineau to be torn down. The contract was supposed to be finalized with CBC Construction at the end of last month, but...
Well, the Barrett family now has relinquished control of the property to us.
That's Jim Hurley, a Seattle-based consultant. The city is holding the notice to proceed for the demolition. Private Public Partnership, LLC, and a local company, Coogan Alaska Construction, want to renovate the apartments, not tear them down. The group has entered into a purchasing agreement with the Barretts, but haven't bought the building yet.
We have a plan that would involve potentially a construction cycle that could be completed in 18 months if we had the cooperation with the city.
The assembly would have to first cancel the bid it awarded to CBC Construction. Hurley says it's still in the development stage, but there are tentative plans to turn the apartments into market rate or subsidized housing. Of course, this would take longer than just tearing it down.
Well, here's the thing. What I do know is that there's not much risk for the taxpayers to listen to what we have to say.
But he says there are risks with the demolition, like the city hoped to recoup over $1 million from the Barretts. After the teardown, Hurley estimates the land is only worth about $200,000. So you would move back in the Gastineau apartments if it was renovated?
I would.
The assembly will be discussing that possibility with the developers. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Annie Fite in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Quentin Chandler in Homer, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council promotes local fishermen and seafood caught by Alaskans for Alaskans. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
The University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.